Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
I think the way we'll run this, we're aiming to run this session, is that before we sort of open it out to questions and comments as previously, we've got two other interventions sort of between 5 and 10 minutes. The first of those is from Jane Usherwood, who's the Secretary-General of Universitas 21. I suspect you'll take the opportunity to say a little about the organisation, but the title of the presentation is An International Perspective on the Student Experience. So over to you, Jane.
Wonderful. Thank you very much indeed, and thank you for the opportunity to join you here. When I was asked to speak about the international perspective on the student experience, I broke that down in my mind in three areas, and I'm going to try and cover all three very quickly. So apologies if this is even more of a whistle-stop tour than a Vice-Chancellor can give. I'm going to look at the international experience for UK students. I'm going to look at international students at UK universities. And for me, I think the most interesting question, which I'm going to come to last, is what are other universities overseas doing about the student experience? And I should apologise in advance in case I use inappropriate language. If I refer to students as customers, I've learned now that I shall never do that again, and I'll try and replace it every time with partners. But I think it's important that we look at what other people are doing and what we can learn from them. Some background first about Universitas 21. I'm not allowed out of the office unless I give this sales pitch. We are an international network of currently 27 research-intensive, and apologies for using that term, again, I've learned about that this morning, of 27 research-intensive universities from around the world. We have members on all continents bar one, and we have no plans to admit a member from Antarctica. We have been in existence now for over 15 years. We were the first such international network. Since the earliest days, we've been focusing on the student, particularly student mobility and overcoming barriers to exchange. And we're currently seeing double-digit increases in mobility between members. Since 2005, over 20,000 students have been on exchange within U21. Now, that sounds really quite impressive and a big number, but if I tell you we have 1 million undergraduates currently across our members, actually it's a relatively small number of students are able to take up exchange, and for many there are very good reasons. It doesn't fit them personally, they can't afford it, it doesn't fit with their programme of study, a whole variety of reasons. So we're now looking at ways of introducing international experiences without having to go on the traditional semester or year-long exchange. Mobility is great. I went on exchange myself when I was a student many, many years ago. But the experience it gives is very deep, but actually quite narrow in terms of affecting the student body. So we need to look for ways of giving students those experiences and enabling them to develop their own experiences. So the first thing I said I'd look at was the international experience for UK students. And I'm going to draw on some research that was published in The Economist recently in an edition called Generation Jobless, some of you may have seen. I think there are four reasons why UK universities should be looking at enabling international experiences for their students. The first is about enrolments. And the research in The Economist was largely US-based research. 2012, enrolment in US universities dropped by 2.3%. It's the first drop in 15 years. That means, in their context, 250,000 fewer students at US universities. Now, I know UK figures are more promising, but I think it's interesting to look at Scotland with a no-fees regime, and enrolments are flat. The idea, I think, my first reason why you should be looking at an international dimension to the experience you provide is the days of growing your way out of trouble by increasing numbers of students, I believe, are over. And it's the quality of experience rather than the quantity. Again, US figures. Since 2007, US student debt has doubled. It now tops $1 trillion. That's $1 trillion. I can't imagine how many noughts that is. But it means that students and their parents and those who are helping fund them want something for the investment that they're making in education. Now, if I contrast that $1 trillion of debt. 52% of AAU graduates, that's the American equivalent of the Russell Group, the Association of American Universities, leave with no debt. They found ways of minimising the debt burden that students face to increase the attractiveness of them, of their universities. So my second reason why you should be looking at an international experience is your partners and their parents want something from the investment that they're making in time and money. Third reason is about job readiness and preparedness, which I believe is a key differentiator or will become a key differentiator in the future in terms of recruitment of students. 53.6% of recent US college graduates are unemployed. So over half the people who make that investment of time and emotional effort to take a college education end up unemployed. Now, the UK figures are much better. UK figure is something around 10%, but according to recent HESA data, about a third of those students are working in roles which, quote, do not require a degree. Now, you may argue that there is more to education than just getting a job at the end of it, but if I go back to my earlier point about the cost, I suspect that those who are making the financial investment do want to see some comeback, which might be in the form of employment, whether or not it's one of those magic jobs that HESA thinks require a degree. And here's the enlightened self-interest point. And I speak here as the mother of a child who will be going to university shortly, I hope. 21% of US graduates under the age of 24 are still living at home, up 13% since 2011. For those of you who have children, unless you want to have them living with you forever, help them get a job when they leave college, please. Apologies, I'm now going to quote David Willetts. Earlier this year, he said, to compete in the global race, the UK must create graduates with a global outlook that makes them more attractive to potential employers and benefits the wider economy. Well, you may want to park some of the utilitarianism of that statement, but nevertheless, I think that we owe it to the students with whom we are working to put them in the best possible position to engage in that global race. CBI did some research, and I've got this from the international unit. 47% of employers are dissatisfied with graduates' international cultural awareness, and 55% of employers are dissatisfied with their foreign language skills. Foreign language skills, and I speak as a graduate linguist, are easier to fill, to make up by employers than those issues of international cultural awareness that you could be helping your students develop during the course of their studies. Research by the British Council and Think Global in 2011 showed 74% of business leaders surveyed thought young people's horizons were not broad enough to operate in a globalised and multicultural economy. Now, you may turn around to me and say, surely Erasmus is the answer to a maiden's prayers. And in some ways it is. 2012, just short of 14,000 UK students went on an Erasmus placement. But look at that as a percentage of the total student body, and look at the research done by the British Council that tells you that most of those were modern foreign language students, and actually very few of our students, amongst the lowest percentage of our European colleagues, are accessing Erasmus and soon to be Erasmus+. The other thing I would suggest that you might usefully do is look at what universities say about themselves in relation to their students. And I don't claim that this will be particularly edifying. You'll see that nearly everybody talks about the employability of their students. So everybody's saying the language. Now it's time to stop just talking the talk, I would say, and start walking the walk. So that's why I think you should be thinking about the international dimension of the experiences that you facilitate for students. What about international students, which is in the UK is a huge market? 2010, approximately 4 million students were studying outside their home country, and UNESCO estimates is that this might rise to 8 million by 2025. 8 million people studying outside their home country. A large and growing mobile population of young people. a massive investment of the, by them and by their countries and by their parents. But it also brings, for those of us in the UK, a huge cultural and intellectual diversity and opportunity. There will be, I predict, an increasing competition between nations to recruit that mobile population. I tell you, education is the third highest export industry in Australia. It's bigger than tourism. They take this incredibly seriously. The International Student Mobility Charter was launched last year by the, forgive me, everything to do with international education has the same set of initials, just in a different order. So EAIE, the European Association of International Education, in partnership with its fellow associations around the world, issued this charter, which looked at ways of facilitating global knowledge mobility, identifying 10 key areas, one of which was linked to intercultural competences. And I'll quote from it. In order to improve the quality of education and the integration of international students in the respective host country, the intercultural competences of faculty and staff at every level of service and education must be well developed and actively applied. I'm very pleased to hear Bill Rammel talk about the importance of staff in relation to the student experience. So we've got a mobile population, an increasingly mobile population. We've got increasing demands by students for quality experiences at all levels. And my third point is, why should you do this? Well, everybody else gets it. In Australia, Department of Education, Employment, Workplace Relations surveyed 38 universities in 2008, and 90% felt international study experience benefited students in a number of ways, including, and this is relevant, I think, greater independence and self-confidence and increased employability skills. I'm going to quote two more vice-chancellors, one of whom is my boss, so everything he says is, of course, perfect and wonderful. And that's Professor Fred Hilmer of University of New South Wales. He said, a global citizen needs to be able to live and work effectively in different cultures. Great universities have always been international in perspective, particularly in research. Knowledge transcends boundaries and recognitions of one's contribution by international peers is highly esteemed. And the important bit, the challenge now is to take this global attitude to knowledge and discovery into learning and teaching and the entire student experience. The second vice-chancellor I'll quote is Professor Teresa Sullivan, University of Virginia in the United States, who pointed out students will be working across borders in their professional lives, working with groups from around the world who are not within the boundaries of the United States. So this is not limited on location. We have to give people the skills and the confidence to work across boundaries wherever. I'm just going to give you some just a few more statistics, because you haven't heard enough yet, about what others are already doing. NUS, which for me means the National University of Singapore, 70% of their graduating students have participated in an international study experience on graduation. 70%. Now, you may well turn around to me and say, Singapore, yeah, that's a country where it doesn't even have a domestic terminal at its airport. And that's true. So let's look at University of Hong Kong. The Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Hong Kong has, for the past several years, required all students to have an international experience of value, that is one that gets them credit, as a condition of graduation. What effect has that had on recruitment? Absolutely none. Actually, their admission scores have continued to rise because it's seen as a highly valuable programme to which you can be admitted. University of Peking, PKU, more than 60% of students and 40% of faculty have an international experience, mainly through academic exchange. That isn't just about going on exchange to an overseas university. It's about making the most of the students who come to your university on exchange. 27% of the students at the University of Melbourne are defined as international, which means non-Australian. Ohio State University, one of its aims is to prepare globally competent graduates. Now, I'm going to also mention the University of Glasgow. This is not just that everybody overseas has got it. A lot of UK universities have also got it. One of their key priorities at the University of Glasgow is preparing students for global employment and citizenship. I won't talk about global citizenship because that would take hours and is a politically contentious phrase anyway. But I guess what I'm saying to you is that the UK needs, I think, to look at student experience in the widest sense and needs to, insofar as you're able, build in an international dimension, which does not have to be limited to going on exchange, but might mean looking at curricular issues, internationalisation at home, making the most of the students and faculty that you already have. But most importantly, I would echo things that I've heard said today already, it's about working in partnership with students to make the most of the experiences they have. And I will just end by mentioning a particular charity, which is called Global Sunrise, which you can look up yourself if you wish, www.globalsunrise.net. That was formed by students from the UK, Australia and Hong Kong, who met on a U21 summer school and decided that what they wanted to do was make a difference to the world in which they live. And they are developing opportunities for students to engage with the developing world, which gives the students skills, gives students intercultural opportunities, and makes a difference to the communities in which they operate. It is student-driven, student-led, student-organised, and we're just very pleased that we're able to facilitate that. But taking on board the point earlier, this is not something done to students. I think there's tremendous potential amongst the student body if only we would listen to them.
Thanks very much, Jane. I think a whole fascinating range of different initiatives and activities. And I think two quick things jumped into my mind. I mean, it'd be interesting to evaluate the extent to which UK universities were embracing internationalisation through either of the three sort of measures that you set out right at the very beginning compared to some of our international counterpart institutions. And the second, perhaps more specific thing, I had the pleasure, I think it's fair to say, of joining the UK's delegation to the ministerial conference in Leuven in 2009. Every 2 years, HE ministers across Europe joined together at a particular European destination with one of Bill's successors. And it was signed up to at that conference that there should be a 20% mobility target across Europe. And as soon as that memorandum was signed, the first thing the civil servants were rushing around concerned about was how can we possibly come up with a definition that allows the UK to escape from its commitment of trying to get 20% of our students to study. I think what they came up with in the end was that it should be an average across Europe. At least that was the interpretation from a particular civil servant that I spoke to. Finally, before we come to questions, our third intervention is from Dr. Peter Lambert, who you'll see is the Associate Dean for Learning and Teaching at the University of Bath. Without wishing to embarrass Peter or indeed perhaps steal his content before he gets to say it, I think it's fair to say that Bath is widely regarded as one of those institutions that really delivers a high quality offer to students, and that is certainly evidenced by its consistently high scores in the NSS. But I'm sure Peter will also outline that it is more than the NSS and the structures that they've got for engagement perhaps allow for them to deliver that. Sort of wearing an old hat previously, I know that the Students' Union there have been very proactive to ensure that high-quality experience is as much their contribution as it is the university's. But on that note, Peter, over to you.
Thank you very much. What Aaron didn't mention is that I'm actually here because Gwen van der Velden, our Director of Learning and Teaching, and very much a leading light in student engagement, in practice and in research, wasn't able to come. That's very kind of you, Aaron. I can't possibly replace Gwen, But what I can do is share what we are trying to do at the University of Bath. And in doing this, what I don't want to do is set out that Bath is better than anywhere else. What we're doing is very relevant for the University of Bath, and it almost stops there. There's no one size fits all. But we are trying to transform relationships between staff, student union, central services, and students. And I'm going to start with NSS, but I'm not going to talk the whole time about NSS. And this isn't because Bath came first in the NSS 2013 rankings. Obviously, we were very proud of it. The marketing team was extremely excited about it. But I think although NSS is extremely important and a very useful tool, and I hope it never goes because it certainly made my job a lot easier in putting the learning and teaching agenda higher up in a research, what claims to be a research-intensive university, I don't think student satisfaction is an all-consuming goal or even a particularly valid goal in itself. And I'll go further that I think an overemphasis on student satisfaction may not be helpful. It might even be counterproductive in the longer term. Now, the reason I say this is because most of the work that we are doing at the University of Bath is not actually about student satisfaction. Instead, it's far more to do with student engagement. Sorry, engagement with students, engagement with staff, and engagement with the student union, using formal and informal mechanisms, really to try and transform, to promote significant change in culture, established culture, attitudes, practices, and really transform the relationship between the university, the staff, and students. I think the evidence might suggest that in the long term, more meaningful and effective engagement with students might lead to improvements in student satisfaction. But that isn't the ultimate goal, I don't think. So first of all, what do we mean by engagement? Well, as we've heard today, engagement does concern all areas of the complexities of what are experiences of students in the multiple forms that they take. But there is an emphasis on learning and teaching. Secondly, that it's at all levels of the university. And this is right from the unit level or the module level, all the way up through programmes, through departments, through faculties, all the way up, not quite as far as Bill, to the executive, but we are working on it. And I think he's very much a leader in that. But with the aim of developing students as stakeholders with a voice and an interest in the university, but even more than that, to use them, and apologies for the buzzword, but as partners who have an actual say in the direction the university is going. And that is absolutely key in the development of the university. So how do we aim to do this at Bath? Well, first of all, the key, I think, the first building block is student representation. We have about 400 student volunteers working on nearly 100 committees, and we are seeking to develop this even further at the top and at the bottom, if you like. Now, the obvious problem is that you can have as much representation as you like, and it can be as tokenistic as you like. You can put a student into a committee with half a dozen professors and half a dozen senior lecturers, but you cannot expect them to do themselves justice in that situation. And I think all of us still struggle with some of the hierarchies among academic colleagues. And I say that as an academic. So the key block is information. We heard this morning about the importance of provision of information, of sharing information from student questionnaires, NSS results, external examiners, right up to the education strategy. What do we mean by an education strategy? What do we include? What do we not include in it? So the information that the students have is absolutely key. And the information the staff has is absolutely key. You'd be amazed how many staff still haven't really got what NSS is, because they're academics and they want to do their research and they sometimes don't want to be annoyed with those kind of things. So it is sharing information. In order to, you know, once you've got the information, well, the second building block for that has to be for an informed and equal body of partners, you have to have support and training. Training in how to sit on committees, support, preparation, briefing, debriefing. For students and also staff. on how to chair committees if there are students, if there's student involvement on the committee. So it's actually engagement with students, but you need to engage with staffs as well. And then fundamental, absolutely fundamental to this, is to strengthen the student union. And I know the student union isn't the be-all and end-all of student engagement, absolutely not, but as a representative, informed and very dynamic pillar of the university. And I think this is absolutely key. This is a resource issue if the student union is to be a partner in developing not only effective engagement, but actually our future direction. So this is a resource issue as well. And then finally, recognising the impact, which again Bill touched on, recognising the impact of engagement publicly. It's not that we did this in terms of academics or staff, it's that the university did it. It's showing the students that when they are engaged and they are pushing for things, there are results. And we launched a very successful, a couple of years ago, You Said We Did campaign. But that was as much for staff as it was for students as well. So taking this a step further, I think in Bath we've taken pride in developing an environment and very much a community in which informed student and staff voice can develop and increasingly act as a partner. But I think personally what was striking about starting in this role in learning and teaching about 3.5 years ago was to see that a lot of the ideas that become eventually university policy, or not eventually, very quickly in fact, are bottom-up. They are starting at a very low level. They're coming from students, sometimes staff, and they're working their ways up through departments, through student staff liaison committees, up into department policy, faculty policy, and eventually university policy. And in a sense, the implication of this is that the university loses control over the agenda in learning and teaching and lets things grow more organically. Now, this is with a vice-chancellor who is very hands-on, I should say, and it still happens. This is actually about what Jess was talking about earlier. This is empowerment. It's empowerment of students, it's skills development for students, but it's also empowerment for staff as well. And I think what's become apparent is that the greater, to me, the greater the level of informed engagement at the level of unit or module, at the level of programme, at the level of discipline, at the level of faculty, the more the greater the level of engagement, the more the benefit to students, staff, and ultimately the university, as long as that message gets back about how things are changing and why they are changing. So I think Bill is absolutely right that there's a very important place for inspirational leadership and institutional leadership from the top in prioritising student engagement. It's very important that the message comes from the top, and it's very important that structures are there that enable the development of the student voice. But I would argue that our experience at Bath indicates that it's leadership, commitment, and genuine buy-in from at all levels, from students, from staff, and from the student union, that actually brings about a more dynamic and equal relationship, and therefore positive and meaningful change in the longer term. And that buy-in is not easy. That's one of the major obstacles. It's easily said. So I think student satisfaction is very important, and I'm very grateful personally to the NSS because it makes my job much, much easier in getting some reluctant academics to engage. But I think if we're talking longer time term, then I think student engagement, which is meaningful and is transformative, is absolutely the future.
Thank you very much, Peter. Well, on that note, we'll invite comments and questions. We've somewhere in the order of 10 minutes or so for those. And so once again, I'll throw it open and wait to see who would like to go first. And again, as you're sort of warming up, perhaps, well, let me start with something. But I am keen for people to come in on to offer perspectives and thoughts, and it may even be that there's a particular point you'd like to make and encourage panelists to respond to. I'm struck and perhaps to an extent slightly surprised that actually over the course of the day, an element of the student experience, which I thought may have got more prominence but hasn't, was touched on by
Stephanie Marshall to a small extent was actually that around employability and the student experience, and actually Jane also touched on it to an extent too. And I was just interested whether in your various roles in the different organisations that you work within, whether there was any evidence that employability and destinations was shaping choice and indeed the experience that that students were having, and the extent to which you feel that the university system in the UK is really sufficiently grappling with that. And I think it'd be interesting, Jane, perhaps specifically, to touch a little bit more on what you referred to as perhaps the UK's relatively poor position in regard to, with regard to delivering graduates who were appreciating cultures from abroad and elsewhere, and whether in the longer term that may actually lead to them being somewhat of a disadvantage compared to graduates coming out of university systems from elsewhere. So I might start with Bill in sort of more generally in relation to employability in the student experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think unless... Well, I almost think students increasingly are taking it as a given that if they are going to choose you, then you have got to demonstrate how you're going to equip them to move into the world of work. And certainly at Bedfordshire, we're looking at this both within the formal curriculum, alongside it, credit-bearing, but also with extracurricular opportunities. I also think, and there is a link to internationalisation, and I speak as a French graduate, where one of the most empowering experiences of my life was living abroad, teaching for a year. And so at Bedfordshire, and what that taught me was it develops a confidence, a resilience, a communication ability that really stands you in good stead in terms of employability. So at Bedfordshire, when I arrived, I said, we're going to fund a really expansive China summer school programme. And I was told from all vice-chancellor, our students won't be interested in that. Well, we put £250,000 behind it, and with 1,000 applications, we funded 150 who went over the summer. The feedback and evaluation is incredibly positive, and we're going to expand it. And I'd like to get to the position where we can make that offer universal, which, you know, is not going to happen overnight, but I think we can get to. And I think that could really equip students. One with a really good experiential opportunity that, quite apart from the world of work, stands them in good stead, but the transferable skills are really powerful moving into the world of work.
Well, I mean, I'd echo that as a German graduate who benefited tremendously from Spain.
French, we always look down on German graduates.
Germans, we always invade you.
I regret saying that now.
Remember Bill's comment about the cameras?
Yeah. There you go. That's why I was never a politician. I couldn't agree more with the transformative impact of international experiences for students. I think we need to recognise that for some students it's never going to be possible for them to go on things like your China programme, which sounds really good. The numbers are very impressive. Is the UK behind? Yes, we're behind continental Europe, a long way behind continental Europe. Part of the problem, research tells us, for UK graduates is a fear of a foreign language will restrict their desire to go abroad. Is that an Anglophone problem? No. Take yourself off to Australia or New Zealand or Canada, and you don't find the same reluctance to go somewhere where first language is not English. But there are other reasons why students don't take up experiences that are offered to them. It doesn't fit. It doesn't fit with their personality. But we've just started doing some research to find out why students aren't taking up opportunities and what opportunities they want. And as a result of that, we've started facilitating online learning communities, so that even if you're not able to physically work with somebody else, you get used to working with people from different cultural backgrounds. And we've also, one of our members, the University of Nottingham, has developed a module to allow people to reflect on their international experiences and the intercultural learning that they've got. Will it put the UK at a disadvantage? Yes, I think it will. The world is becoming increasingly smaller. Students around the world are moving. Look at those 8 million who are prepared to study, or UNESCO think will be prepared to study outside their home country. Look at the number of students that are taking up either short-term or semester-long exchange possibilities. There are more people who are able to work in different contexts. Just take one look at the number of non-UK leaders of FTSE 100 companies that we've got. A few years ago, you would have found each FTSE 100 company was led by a Brit, possibly by an American. Now look at the number of continental Europeans that there are, because they're learning the language. They're learning how to work in an Anglo-Saxon way. In the 19th century, the phrase was, go west, young man. In the 21st century, it's going to be, go east, young woman. And, you know, we're either on that train or we're left behind, and we become a very nice little theme park that people come and look at.
Thanks, Jane. Peter.
I'm actually a graduate of Spanish, so we have to settle on the... And we're growing. Yes, I think employability, Bath does have very good rates of employability, and this is one of the reasons students state that they want to come and study. But I think there are three things I just wanted to say. First of all, that NSS has been very useful in this again, because it's made us try to build in employability into the curriculum. It's not enough just to wait till the final year and then say, right, here's the careers office, come along. Students are actually demanding now that we have it built into the curriculum, and that also that we invite alumni back regularly to talk about different kinds of careers they've done with the degree. The second thing, I think one of the things we're trying to get across is the idea of skills development and transferable skills, and it's closing that feedback loop. Students have these skills. Students have developed them over the previous 4 years, but they don't put them down on their CV. They don't link their achievements with their skills. So it's often simply pointing out to students, these are the skills for employability that you have learnt on this 3 or 4 year degree. And the other thing I think that we've alluded to beforehand is placements. Is absolutely key. And placements in a country with a foreign language is even better. And I think the students, in terms of employability, placements set them apart. So I think we promote that.
This is the final call, as it were. Ah, fantastic. We have a couple of calls. So, Alex, if you just say who you are again and where you're from.
Alex Buckley from the HEA. I guess this question is primarily for you, Peter, but there's a lot of interest now in engagement versus satisfaction. But is there an element of just the measured versus the non-measured? So satisfaction is relentlessly measured, and it's a performance management tool. And are people shifting more towards engagement because it's not measured? So my question for you is, Bath is very good at student engagement. What would happen if it started to be relentlessly measured and put in the key information set? Now, obviously, initially, you'd love that because you do it really well. But what impact would it have on the kind of atmosphere and the culture of student engagement activities if they started to be metrics, if you see what I mean? Partly because that's a real possibility, and partly is that why people are down on satisfaction? Just because what they're actually down on is league tables.
Thanks very much, Alex. And we'll also take the question from Yaz as well.
Thanks a lot. Yaz, El Hakim Winchester. And I was very interested about the comment you made, Bill, about the grade calculator, so students can see every step of the way kind of how each assessment's impacting it. Obviously, there's a national discussion and partly internationally driven around the GPA model and the honours model. And I was just wondering about panellists' views of that granularity being useful for the student experience, or maybe a focus on the minutiae, taking students away from the focus on learning slightly, and comments about international perceptions of it too. Thanks.
Perhaps I'll just add before we go to the panellists that, and there's a question from Andy as well, that I think yesterday the Vice-Chancellor of Leicester, Bob Burgess, who's overseeing a great deal of work looking at degree classifications more generally, as sort of, I think perhaps because he's got 6 months left in the job before he retires, is sort of starting to beat the drum that bit more vociferously to suggest that the whole degree classification system really is no longer fit for purpose now compared to when it was originally brought
brought in so many decades ago. So worth throwing that into the mix. We'll take the final question from Andy.
Yeah, Andy Parsons, Loughborough Students' Union. I was really interested in the comment you made, Peter, about levelling the playing field a little bit when it comes to student representatives finding themselves in a room with a group of professors who mark their exams, who determine their future careers. And I wondered what the panellists, perhaps Bill and even Aaron as well, could say about making telling the truth to power a little bit easier for student representatives right the way across the board.
Super. Thanks, Eddie. Well, should we start with Peter and work our way along?
It was actually really nice following the other two because I got inspired as they went along. I'll start off with engagement. I think I would still argue that engagement does have a huge impact on student satisfaction. I think there is a relationship there. I think the difficulty about NESI is actually introducing those metrics. I think it is my limited understanding of it would indicate that it's very difficult to actually measure those and transform them into any kind of league table. So I think I'm quite happy with the current situation because I do see a relationship between them. And, I mean, Bath might sink to 25th next year, and you can tell me I was completely wrong. It might happen. But I do think that student engagement is the ultimate game, but I don't see how that can be measured. I think that's far more difficult, and I'm not sure how we'd advance on that. In terms of, do you want to do it question by question, or do you want to do it?
If you offer your thoughts on the questions you feel were relevant to you,
or specific. All three. The GPA, all I know, that the University of Bath is looking at percentages, rather as thinking of getting rid of classifications, but not GPA, certainly. The one about representation, the practical difficulties of having student representation, I think, is a really key point. It's a very difficult one. Even if students are in position for 2 years, it is still difficult for a 22-year-old to be there among, in a very hierarchical organisation, if you like, or perceptions of hierarchy in certain rooms. The ways that we try to do it, as I said, is by training, briefing, debriefing, informal meetings with the chair, training with the chair, and actually having slots in there where we have chair's business. You can also have a slot saying issues for the students, and you actually give the student the podium in a faculty learning, teaching, quality committee or SSLC and say, what are the issues for you? And actually hand over the leadership, if you like, of that section of the committee to the students. But it is a game that we're all trying to improve on because they are very real obstacles to proper partnership, I think.
I just want to mention something about this telling truth to power point because I hear what the UK is saying. And if you look at continental Europe, for a long time they've had shared governance. And if you go to continental European universities, you will see equal numbers of students on the management committee with management representative vice chancellor and vice chancellor's team. And if you go to some European universities, you will see public accountability of the vice chancellor. You might like to introduce this, where once a year the vice chancellor has to account publicly to the whole of the student body for what the university has done. My favourite place is my member in Sweden, Lund University. This is done in public on the 1st of May, come rain or snow, and the poor vice chancellor stands outside for 2 hours and explains to the assembled student body, who are all, of course, in the coffee houses with windows open, what exactly the university has done over the last 12 months. So I think there are models that we could look at overseas, but I think supporting the students through it. We have student representatives on our management committee as well, and we never seem to have a difficulty with them telling truth to power at all, quite the reverse, and it's quite good for vice chancellors to hear the student voice directly. Degree classification, if I had a crystal ball, I would say it's going. No one round the world is seeking to introduce the UK system anywhere. There are pluses and minuses to grade point averages. The biggest higher education market is wedded to them because they're used to it. There aren't that many places seeking to introduce it, though. So I think something will replace the UK system. in probably the not too distant future if we are to compete in a global marketplace. Whatever we replace it with will be flawed just in different ways.
I might just say something briefly on Andy's question. I think the points are well made about the need to develop effective systems for training and support. But the two things that perhaps haven't been said that I would touch on, referring back to previous experience, the first would be actually the importance of empowering the representative with research and a strong evidence base to back up what they're saying. Because actually, yes, if you are talking and referring or indeed relying on anecdote, so, you know, on my course, I noticed X, Y, and Z, then perhaps for very understandable reasons, those you're wishing to make that case to will sort of attack the evidence base. And I'm not sure that it's variable across students' unions, to be honest, the extent to which they are properly equipping their officers to go into meetings with a strong evidence base. I think the more enlightened universities, when their planning officers or equivalents are dissecting and doing their own analysis of the NSS or other institutional surveys, they're making that analysis available to the students' unions. Perhaps where that relationship isn't the same, the student union are going off and doing their own analysis. So I think I'd make the point on evidence first. And the second, I think, is harder to be specific about, but I think it's more generally about culture and the way in which the institution tries to develop and foster a relationship with the students' union, and the extent to which it's framed around sort of an antagonistic relationship, whereby if it's framed as if you ask for 10 things, we'll probably give you one or two. I think that sort of perhaps sets up the wrong balance for the relationship. I think if it's one which is actually we have a shared interest, surely what the student union wants and what the institution wants is more often going to be the same than it is going to be different. So if you can work out actually where your shared agendas are and build up that sort of strength of partnership first, when there are going to be, and there will still be, of course, things where there is either a difference of opinion or either desired different outcomes, it's a lot easier to make those the case for those differences because you've already built up a relationship which has in part been built up on where you've got shared objectives. So I think those two things are important. In terms of getting someone up to speed to be familiar with those things very quickly, that's not easily solved. And I suppose my reflection on seeing the different routes through which different officers eventually perhaps take sabbatical roles specifically in students' unions, I've been struck, and it was my own route, which was the course rep route, interestingly, into being a sabbatical officer. I think that was my experiences on the student staff consultative committees and others actually helped me best in learning and teaching committees particularly. But clearly it's really important, and it's still really legitimate to have sabbatical officers that come from a society base, from a sports base, from a media base, because they help you to engage with those constituencies in your student population. But I'm not sure those backgrounds, put really crudely, are always the best preparation for the way in which universities make decisions, which is around the committee structure. It's a difficult one because I see the value of both, and I'll leave it there. Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an instinctive fan of GPA. What's the function of degree classification boundaries, actually, both on the part of the candidate and the employer? It's about differentiation. And my worry with GPA is that we're pandering to that view that is the best way to judge a candidate, and that somebody who gets 68% overall is better than someone who gets 67%. Well, you know, if you think that, then, and you know, people are going to be sifted on that basis. So I wouldn't do it. And, you know, I'm not naive. There is a need for some differentiation, and I think degree classification largely does that. But I think we need to go much further, and that's where I think the Higher Education Achievement Report, if we can get it up and running in the right way, has got real merit. Because I'll tell you this, you know, when I'm looking for a candidate for a graduate starting job, then I think demonstration and evidence beyond the curriculum that they've undertaken some form of civic leadership, for want of a better phrase, speaks far more powerfully than whether they got a 2-1 or a first, or whether they got 68 or 67%. So I think you need a broader representation. In terms of Andy's point, and it's not often I can't see Andy, but, you know, speaking truth to power, I think you need to do it in a variety of ways. I certainly think you can't do it exclusively through the student union. I mean, surveys, and at Bedfordshire, we're developing YouGov-style surveys, focus groups, the use of representatives, but also the formal representational channels as well. And I mentioned, you know, that we are, I think, leading the way with the student union president sitting on the Vice-Chancellor's executive group. I have to bear in mind that one year we're going to elect a trot who will make my life a misery. But that's you know, the challenge that you face. But you've then got to equip people, whether it's as a course rep, whether it's as a student union sabbatical, to undertake that role. And why does it matter, and what's the benefit of it? Take it out of the world of higher education and take, and I'm trying to remember the phrase, the worker representational model, is it Mitbestimmung in Germany? And, you know, you look at the German productivity levels over decades through that model of involving representatives within senior decision-making. I think it's got an awful lot going for it.
Great. Well, can I just thank you for your questions and comments, but perhaps also take the opportunity to thank again each of the panellists for their really thoughtful and thought-provoking presentations. So if we can thank them in the usual way, please.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.